Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center meteorologist Adam Carroll. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning. Yeah, we had some snow overnight across the Wasatch Back, Park City, led to some slick or slippery, slushy roads as well. Things more or less came to an end, though, into the latter half of the commute, which allowed for, time to clear things out on roadways and just become more wet than anything else. But we're going to be in and out of snow showers on the Wasatch Back here for the remainder of the day and really for the remainder of the next couple of days, only because we've got this area below pressure that it's moving very slowly, and it continues to eject precipitation into Utah. But as it moves slowly to the east, the wraparound from the area of low pressure will continue to bring snow to the Wasatch Back and Park City here over the course of the next few days. So, all told, though it may not look like it's going to accumulate and just stick around, we are still looking at a 2 to 4 inch range for the Wasatch Back, with, of course, higher amounts in the mountains. They picked up 4 inches at Park City here the overnight hours, and we'll keep this going through Saturday, it looks like, for Park City, Heber, the Wasatch Back, as it really will take all the way up until Sunday to kind of completely clear this storm from the area. But, it does still allow for moisture. It still allows precipitation to fall, even if it doesn't overall accumulate and stick around over the course of the next few days. It will do that. And you'll want to have some touch and go travel, especially over Parley. So keep that in mind. But Sunday looks much, much better with regards to our weather, and our temperatures will go up from there, because we'll stay in the 30s until Sunday when we get back into the 40s on Sunday and Monday, and then another storm for Tuesday.
Okay. Hey, thanks, Adam.
Yeah.
And on the phone with us with a look in the backcountry, and we've got Mark from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. The snow became wet and damp last weekend with warm temperatures. It's refrozen, and that hard surface is underneath the several inches of new snow we got yesterday and last night. Conditions are slowly improving, but the good news is that avalanches are unlikely and the danger is low. So just watch out for some minor sloughing within the snow that is falling and will fall today.
Thanks, Mark. Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, we'll be checking in with Summit County Councilmember Roger Armstrong. Summit County Representative for District 53, Kara Berklin, recapping the legislative session from her point of view, and newly named Executive Director of the National Ability Center, Dan Grouser, talking about his new job and his vision for the NAC. Stay tuned. Well, the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission Tuesday night voted to grant a conditional use permit for a group home in Highland Estates intended to help teenage girls facing emotional issues. As KPCW's Rick Bruff reports, the Snyderville Planning Commission hammered out a decision literally at the 11th hour, given that the applicant was up against a deadline of her own.
The application is asking to convert an existing 13,000-square-foot facility on Highland Drive, including a home, accessory building, and barn, for the ROOTS program, which stands for Retaining Our Original Truth. Program Director Tammy Black said the facility would be designed for girls between 14 to 18 years old, struggling with depression, anxiety, school failure, trauma, and similar mental health concerns. The facility would accommodate up to 30 girls, as well as 7 staff members. The tenants would be staying for 9 to 12 months. A public hearing heard from nearly 20 people, ranging from concerned neighbors asking for mitigation measures to past participants in the program and industry professionals supporting ROOTS. At the tail end of a long agenda, the proposal had the Snyderville Commission meeting past 10 p.m. A motion was made to continue the item to their next regular meeting, March 23rd. But Blatt said on the 23rd, her option to buy the property expires. She said after waiting several months to get before the Snyderville Commission, she was hoping for a decision Tuesday. A significant concern from neighbors and planning commissioners was the impact of converting a single-family residence into a facility holding up to 37 people. Ultimately, the Planning Commission's approval called for a compliance review after a year, which would look at the number of tenants, plus issues like water, the septic system for the facility, and trash. There will also be no parking on Highland Drive and no subleasing of the property. Black also said she will be putting up a privacy fence, and lights out at the facility will be 9:30 to 10. For KPCW, I'm Rick Broff.
Well, as we've been hearing, it's been a year since COVID first arrived in Summit County. Officials put measures in place early, and looking back, the head of the health department feels good about having to make the right moves to mitigate the spread of COVID-19. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more.
Summit County Public Health Director Rich Bulla uses data to measure his team's success over the past year. With the Utah mask mandate ending on April 10th, he doesn't regret the shutdowns, the masking requirements, and the social distancing restrictions put in place at the beginning and throughout the pandemic crisis.
If we look at mortality rates, case fatality rate, certainly we can't take all of the credit for that. We have a healthy population. We've got, you know, a relatively well-to-do population, a great medical system. But our case fatality rate is extraordinarily low in Summit County. To put it in perspective, every state surrounding Utah has case fatality rates over 100 per 100,000. The lowest in the country is 31 per 100,000. That's Hawaii. Utah is at 62, and Summit County is at 24.
The first case identified in Summit County was an employee who worked at a popular Park City Main Street bar. Bulo said he had to close the business down because hundreds of people could have been infected within 10 days when the employee had last worked.
So we released that name, that business name, in an effort to have people reach out to us and say, I was there. And in fact, that was very successful. We had a lot of people contact us, and it allowed us to move down that chain of investigation and help mitigate the spread.
Bulo said nationally 10% of new COVID cases are variants. The data are not clear that the vaccines protect from the variants.
And there's some evidence to suggest that they're not real protective of the variant from Brazil and South Africa. So brings an important point forward. We still need to be careful. It is true that cases are dropping. We're getting people vaccinated. We've got a fair number of people estimated to be somewhere in the ballpark of 20% of the population has already had COVID, but we don't know really what these variants are going to do moving forward.
Bulo said Summit County is filling vaccine appointments quickly, which isn't the case throughout the state. He is pleased with the progress the health department is making to vaccinate high-risk populations and people over 65. He expects that about 95% of them will be vaccinated soon.
The big question for us is, are those individuals that chose not to be vaccinated, or have we missed people? It could also be the fact that those people aren't in the county. You know, they're counted as residents, but they may not be here.
His department is now focused on finding ways to expand access, remove barriers, and make it easier for people to get the vaccine. The CDC guidelines recommend people who had COVID wait 90 days before being vaccinated. Vaccine reactions seem to happen in younger people.
By far, the majority of people don't have any reaction to that first dose, maybe a little bit of a sore arm. It's the second dose where you see a little higher frequency of aches and pains and chills. And
Bulo said the data suggests strongly that the second dose should not be skipped, but said studies are ongoing to determine differently. With Utah's mask mandate ending on April 10th, Governor Spencer Cox announced all adults would be able to sign up for a vaccine on April 1st. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
Good morning. Well, the Summit County Council met yesterday. On the phone with a recap of the meeting, I have Council Member Roger Armstrong. Good morning, Raj.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you. So the council discussed the Community Renewable Energy Program. Council didn't take a vote, but it looks like everyone on the council supports the program.
Yeah, I think so. You know, we've got an initiative to become 100% renewable in county operations, which we should hit based on our multi-party agreement with Rocky Mountain Power and Salt Lake City and Park City for the Tooele facility by 2023. And this will enable us to obtain renewable energy for our residents in Summit County. And if it works well enough, I anticipate that would put us way ahead of our schedule on that as well. There are some pieces of it that, you know, I think were a little bit of head scratchers, such as voting rights. But as explained to the county attorney, this was sort of a take it or leave it deal at this point. It's been, you know, the result of months of negotiations, and at this point, we probably can't change much in it, but I think the risk is relatively low, so we supported it.
Yeah. So what about the county being an anchor community in the program? Are you in favor of that?
I am. I think if the outside risk is, you know, in the $57,000 range, there are probably other scenarios where the economic risk could go higher, but they would be, I think, pretty unusual. It would seem that Salt Lake City is probably as committed to this process as we are, and with them as the big dog financially in this, you know, these contributions are all population-based and possibly energy load-based, and they're going to be way ahead of us. So I think that we're probably in good shape. I don't think we'll be at the lowest rung because I anticipate that some of these communities, there's probably a reasonable possibility that they will drop out. But even if the minimum numbers stay in, and we're looking at a $57,000 overall commitment to get where we want to go, that seems to be a pretty reasonable risk.
Okay, but what if some of the other communities do drop out? Does that change the county's financial obligation?
It does, but it still is based on our population. And going into this, we're at only 3%. So if you start watering that down, it would change it dramatically if the highest population counties dropped out, because then the percentages, you know, were less than 3%, I think, or about 3% going into this. And if some of the smaller counties dropped out, it's probably not going to change our percentage that dramatically, and we kind of know where that lines up. But if the Ogdens and Salt Lake City and some of the other much larger population communities dropped out, that would change it. But I think if they were to drop out, we would probably have a bigger problem with the design of the program or some other issue that would cause them to drop out. And we would have the right to drop out as well, and we might very well do that if something were going sideways.
All right. And then you kind of mentioned the big dogs like Salt Lake City. Do they actually control this process? There was some talk of some weighted voting on the board for the program.
They can. And that was a part that we probably had the greatest discussion about. And you know, that's a situation where two of the participants can request that an issue be subject to weighted voting. So population, I assume, and electric load would kind of carry the day there. And you'd have to have a majority based on the weighted vote. But, you know, going into this, Salt Lake City has 28%. So they would have to cobble together another 22 or 23%. To pass an initiative. So if they were able to join up with some of the larger jurisdictions, they could possibly pull something in a different direction. But, you know, we've been working on these renewable issues almost from the time I got to council. I led a group to California in, I don't know, probably 2013 or 14 to look at their renewable energy programs there. And Salt Lake City was a very committed partner at that time. And you know, we've all been working together on these for a number of years, and I think that our interests are consistent enough that it's probably a relatively small risk. But, you know, optically, it does and should make us pause and wonder what the, you know, possible outcomes could be.
Yeah. So what happens from here? I mean, this month, the five anchor communities will be determined?
Well, hopefully it'll be more than five. I mean, it can, you know, be significantly more than that. But I think by the end of July, May, I think we have to commit first monies go in. I think by the end of June or July, and then county money goes in by the end of, I think, January 22. So there are several steps between now and when we actually have to provide our funding.
Okay. Let's see. Council made some appointments to the planning commissions. The council reappointed Ryan Dickey and John Cusera to the Snyderville board. On the east side, you reappointed Don Sargent and then named a new person, Alex Peterson. Can you tell us a little bit about Alex?
Yeah, Alex has been around for a long time, and if you look at his resume, it's very impressive. He's a retired Marine colonel, and I have, you know, had an opportunity throughout my several different kinds of careers and jobs to hire Marines, and they are one of the safest hires you can make. They work harder than a lot of people, and they tend to be very strategic in their thinking. Alex combines that Marine background with a legal background. He's a lawyer, and he's just a really smart guy. I worked with him when we were going through the process of kind of restructuring our public defender program. And he was just a real joy. He was collaborative. He was smart. He made excellent comments. And I think he's just, I think we, I'm constantly amazed at the kind of skill sets and talent that we have to choose from in this community, because we have so many people from so many different walks of life who've been successful in their various pursuits. And when they step up to offer themselves for public service, it's a real treat. And Alex is, I think, just at kind of the top rung of that. So we're fortunate to get somebody like him that's willing to put in the time that it's going to take to be a planning commissioner. So he's a good ad.
All right. There was a discussion about the neighborhood mixed-use zone. Council did not take a vote on it. Council member Chris Robinson did raise an issue, I think, if I understand right, that what if you're a property owner and someone develops a neighborhood mixed-use zone right next to you? What's the setback?
Yeah, he is concerned about that. I am too. I mean, you know, when we're talking about 45-foot heights, I guess, you know, in a neighborhood, if you think of, if somebody wanted to put a 45-foot building in the middle of a residential development in Prospector adjacent to homes, people would, I mean, I think we saw some of that a few years ago when there was talk of moving the electric facility over there. And I think we do have to pause and think about that. I guess from a process standpoint, this NMU is combined with a master plan development. So somebody has to come in and apply for the rezone, and in tandem with that, and the rezone is only allowed in certain specific areas that are shown on the general plan map. And in tandem with that application for the rezone is a master plan development that has to be submitted. And that's where they start to sketch out with more specificity, you know, the where's and the what's and the widths and the setbacks and heights and parking and, you know, all of the details that are going to make this project work or not work. And it's largely discretionary for the county. The more bells and whistles and requirements that we put in either the NMU or the MPD, the more locked in we are to those things, and sometimes to our detriment. I mean, if we want to just say no to something, but we've said that a certain standard is okay, but we don't like it in this particular development, having it as something that is available and meets a standard could make it harder for us to say no to it. So finding that balance between flexibility and certainty going in is what we're really working on right now with this NMU process. I think for the most part, the NMU is probably headed toward an approval just based on the temperature in the room. But I do think that there are still some more issues that we need to work out. Some of them, I mentioned density is an issue because it's listed in the NMU. And density is not generally something that we articulate with any kind of specificity as it relates to commercial developments. They're bounded, that density is limited by the setbacks, by the available space to actually put a building in, the heights, the widths, the setbacks, the amount of land available. Here, because it's mixed use, you know, we're looking at including affordable housing in that mix. And I think that I'd like to make sure that we think that through carefully before we approve something that could result in, you know, a modicum of retail and commercial operations and then a massive residential development.
So if the zone is going to be guided by the MPD process, when does the council sit down and talk about MPDs?
That's going to be next up. I mean, I think we've kind of put a pin in this so that we can start to work on that before. Well, I believe we'll be approving both of those together ultimately.
So, oh, okay. So it does happen before the approval of the zone.
Correct. Yeah, it's a process. So this process of approving the NMU, I think we will make that hand in hand with the development of the MPD, which will be brought forward to us soon, so that we can see how these things fit hand in glove together. And then as in the practical application, that process will be worked through together with the MPD and the and the NMU kind of going through a parallel process.
Okay. A couple of other issues, but I don't have much time here, so let's move through. The council quickly approved that temporary zoning ordinance for a six-month moratorium on accessory buildings, and we've got a public hearing set then for March 23rd. I guess there is a public hearing, is my understanding, with the Snyderville Planning on code amendments for accessory buildings.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, and then go from there.
The Planning Commission would be doing that. Yep.
All right. And then you spoke something briefly during council comments, and you said that the county needs to take a deep dive into its efforts to get affordable and attainable housing. Can you sum that up quickly?
Yeah, it's something that's really been nagging at me over the past, you know, going back into 2020, how we're approaching affordable housing. And I think we're seeing, you know, the Highland Flats application had an affordable housing element to it. Dakota Pacific has an affordable housing element to it. Something that we're seeing more and more. And I'm not sure that we've really asked all of the questions that we need to ask about adding residential housing generally and the breadth of those densities. You know, it typically doesn't pay for itself. It generates additional need for services, fire and police and infrastructure and other services. Typically, you know, those kinds of developments also generate more workers because somebody has to repair and maintain and, you know, do other things in conjunction with those. And against the backdrop of COVID-19 and this influx of people into this area, whether it's second homeowners that are moving in and occupying their homes for a longer period, and perhaps remote work, extending and expanding that, or people that have just decided that they want to leave the cities and move here full time, where I think we're going through a mini population growth here. And when I look at, you know, the economic development recommendations that we are 2,000 units short right now, at close to three people per unit, somewhere between 2.4 and 2.7 people per unit, that's 6,000 people. And, you know, we say, well, if we build them close to transit centers, we're not going to have a traffic problem. I'm not sure that's true, because an uptake of 15% ridership, which is good ridership on a transit system, means 85% of those new bodies in the community are going to be driving around this community in cars, impacting trails, impacting slopes. So I think, you know, without assigning, economic levels to populations, movements in the county, we've got to look at what we're doing in terms of growth and adding new bodies and what we're accomplishing doing that. And I think we haven't had that kind of extremely extensive discussion of impacts and benefits and what this could look like at the end of the next 10 years. And I think it's irresponsible for us to continue to go forward on an initiative that we haven't really picked apart thoroughly.
So as long as we continue to build developments that require minimum wage service workers, we're never going to build our way out of this. And I guess that's why, then why does the council then continue to consider projects? And I hate to pick on Dakota Pacific, but it is a good example. It's continuing to build the same old thing, which only drives the need for more affordable housing.
You're absolutely right. And that's really kind of what hyper-focused it for me, is these new pieces coming in. We've got a lot that are in the system right now, nearly 1,000 units between Silver Creek Village, the Canyons, Lincoln Station. We've got a number of projects coming online, and, you know, 800 to 1,000 new units maybe. I think Jeff will tell you it's less, but in terms of bodies, it's there or above. We've got we've got deed restrictions in place on them, but they haven't been tested. We saw at Bear Hollow, you know, the prior commission put deed restrictions on those properties, and some of them have failed, and we've got nightly rentals there. So if we do it wrong, we've got a problem. And I think we've also seen the nightly rental phenomenon has taken a significant number of properties, out of the long-term rental market and converted them to short-term nightly rentals. And that's profoundly affected the availability of rental housing in the community, and it's made it easier. So do we, as you said, build our way out, or do we start looking at maybe trying to incentivize landowners to convert those back to long-term rentals. Can we do that at a local level? Do we do it through our state legislature? How do we solve the problem without necessarily adding more units?
Okay, I've got to leave it there. Roger, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie. Be well.
That's Summit County Councilmember Roger Armstrong. This was State Representative Kara Berkland's freshman year as a state lawmaker for District 53. She was appointed in April 2020, that after Logan Wild had resigned to take on a new state job. Kara joins me now on the phone with a recap of the session. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. So how did it go for you the first year? I know that you'd had some practice in interim sessions last year, but again, this was kind of the first full session.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was actually a good experience. I really feel like I made some movement on several bills that I got passed or bills that I want to pass that constituents had brought to me. And I think we've got some good movement there to get some future passage of those bills. So I'm really pleased with the session. Sure. I love that we didn't have a whole lot of bills coming from the House. I think 302 were sent to the governor's office from the House of Representatives, which I think is a far better number than 600, 700, 800 in past days.
All right. So it sounds like you were busy. My understanding, you sponsored 8 bills, also the floor sponsor of 1 bill. And in the meantime, a high school basketball referee. Let's see, and what, 6 children as well, I think, huh?
Yes, yeah. So I also coach a high school basketball team, and our team won the 3A state championship during that time period, and I work at a law firm. So, but luckily, the best part of being in the session was all of that kind of moves aside, and I focused 100% on the session. So it was actually a nice break to be able to just say, this is the one thing I'm doing for the next 7 weeks, nothing else. A little bit of coaching, but that was really about it. As opposed to just the day-to-day where it goes from being at the firm, being at the practices, being at games, being a mom. I mean, it was a nice break from the busyness of the everyday life, actually.
Well, a couple of your bills did revolve around sports, a resolution to honor Utah Jazz player Donovan Mitchell. But certainly the main focus was the bill banning transgender girls from women's sports, House Bill 302. The bill made it through the House, later faltered in a Senate committee hearing when it was tabled. So what happened there? Do you know?
Well, you know, I can't speak for how all the committee members felt. I did talk to a few of them, and they had expressed support of the bill, but just felt like maybe there needs to be more time, more community discussion to explain the overall intent and opportunities that are otherwise there for these kids. And then it could be more successful with more community buy-in and support, which is understandable.
Yeah, and it certainly received a lot of attention and a lot of support, also many people in opposition. Anything that you would have changed about the bill in hindsight, or do you think we'll see that come forward?
There are a few things we tweaked and changed along the way that just made more sense. I think moving forward, the most important thing is I think there's a lot of misconception about high school sports as they are today. You know, the biggest thing I constantly heard was, a transgender girl isn't comfortable playing on the boys' team. And I said, I completely understand that. And that's a problem. Mm-hmm. Because I can tell you right now, there's a lot of cisgender girls who are extremely uncomfortable playing on the boys' team. If they want to play baseball, if they want to play football, if they want to play lacrosse and their school doesn't have it. There's a lot of times that girls, cisgender or transgender, they have no other choice but to play on a boys' team. And if they're not comfortable there, that's a cultural change we need to make, where we don't have girls feeling so uncomfortable or threatened in a group of boys when they're out there to play a sport. But so there's, I think, a lot of conversations that could be had that kind of help strengthen our youth, their sports programs, and create the camaraderie that everyone is searching for anyway, because currently it doesn't truly exist for a lot of girls looking to play certain sports, and their only option in our state is to play with boys.
Yeah. I mean, you were very concerned, though, about how this was going to impact trans girls, impacting girls' sports in general. I mean, do we really have a problem, though, with trans girls taking away high school girls' scholarships for college and things like that? Because we certainly have seen that happen, but it just seems so few and far between.
Yeah, it's certainly not a problem here in our state currently. Now, my fear is, do we wait until it's happened, or do we wait until there's a transgender girl who's come in and won a scholarship to go, oh, shoot, we should have done something about that. And now the parents of the cisgender girls are filing lawsuits, or, you know, by sitting and waiting and not having a good plan in place, I feel like we actually will do more damage going forward to both the transgender kids and the cisgender kids. I talked to the parent of one of the transgender kids from another state whose child is involved in a lawsuit because the parents are claiming that their daughter was, you know, unrightfully removed from a podium. And the mother said straight up to me, I would never have had my daughter play sports on the girls' team if I knew this was going to happen. This has been a horrible process. So it's not just about protecting the cisgender girls. It's also looking out for the best interest, knowing what's likely to happen to the transgender girls that participate. And if we can have the conversation, if we can have good dialogue, and we can make sure that all the adults in the room can take a positive approach to this and find a positive solution, I feel like in the long run, fewer kids will be vilified, both on the transgender side and the cisgender side.
Yeah. A number of LGBTQ organizations reached out to you to try and work on the bill. Did you think you learned more about the community and their requests because of this bill?
You know, I have a great respect for Equality Utah and a lot of different people who are not part of Equality Utah, but are LGBTQ. So I've got to be honest, though, their ultimate compromise is saying trans girls play on the girls' team, period. And there's got to be give and take. There's got to be more than that, because that's just, it's not going to happen in most states. As we've seen, more and more states are, I think there's three or four now, where the governor is going to be signing a bill similar to mine, where they're just saying no. So we have an opportunity in Utah to come up with a really good solution, but there has to be give and take. Because like I said, there's girls today who are uncomfortable playing on the boys' football team, but that's their only option if they want to play sports.
Yeah,
but there's got to be a compromise for them, and there's got to be a compromise for the transgender girls who aren't comfortable playing with boys. Where do they go? How do they play? Let's talk about it. But it can't just be they play or it's discrimination. You know, it's not a good way to move the needle for either side. And I did meet with Equality Utah, I think, four or five times during the seven-week session. I met with a lot of people who are gay and transgender or their parents. I had a lot of conversations so that people felt like they were involved, and those conversations will just need to continue.
All right, get on to another of your bills, House Bill 154, which set a timeline for the completion of investigation into an officer's use of force. It also requires certain information in public online. One of the lines of the bill said, if feasible, prior to any use of deadly force, a peace officer should identify himself or herself as a peace officer, give a clear oral warning of his or her intent to use a firearm or other physical force. It did pass the House unanimously, with three representatives being absent, but it did fail the Senate floor on the last night of the session in a 13-15 vote. This certainly comes after a number of high-profile cases nationally where officers were called into question for use of their force. But what isn't that what we do already? Let people know?
Yeah, that bill was unfortunately one of the saddest bills to see it not moving forward for me. It does currently in law say, if feasible, they should do this. But the language we put in there, and I worked with law enforcement since last June on this legislation, making sure that it was something that they supported. It in committee hearing in the House side, it had support from the Sheriff's Association, the Police Chiefs Association, and the AG's office. So I can't speak to why the Senate didn't pass it. However, it is something that needs to be dealt with. And one of the reasons I ran this bill was because there's a city council member here in our state who is Black, who was driving his car and the taillight was out. He got pulled over. His car window wouldn't roll down because it was broken. So he started to crack his door. The officers got pretty upset that he was cracking his door and told him to order him out of the car. It was dark. It was night. He was a tall, big black man. He gets out of his car, and there's two guns pointed at him. No one told him, okay, you're going to open your door, and we're going to have our guns drawn because you're getting out of your car at this traffic stop. And it just escalated. And he's a good man. He's a, you know, he's an elected representative in his community. And he said it terrified him. And there was no warning. There was no, like, okay, sir, I understand your window doesn't roll down. If you get out of your car, you're going to need to understand we're going to have our guns drawn. Just something. Something to let them know that this is going to escalate so you're prepared for it. You know, and the saddest part is that may not have happened if another officer was, you know, on call that night, right? That may not be what the majority of officers do, but that was unfortunately his experience. And I can tell you, I have been pulled over. And my window, if I'm driving my son's car, perhaps the window one time didn't roll down, and it didn't. And the officer just let me talk through the door cracked. I wasn't ordered out of the car. You know, just we've got some changes. It's not a negative thing towards law enforcement. Every industry needs to look at adapting and making changes to improve their line of business. Every single industry. Law enforcement is just one of those industries where if we can figure out ways to do it better, if we can figure out ways to make people safer and officers more safe, let's do it.
So will you bring this back then? Since it had bipartisan support.
It did.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. COVID bills and local power, the endgame bill, which ends the state mask mandate by April 10th, but also allows local health departments to extend those mandates. And the executive power bills basically checks and balances on the governor and the executive department and state and local health departments. Both of these bills give local municipalities more power than they currently have. Do you feel like the legislature did a good job of allowing local authorities to keep power?
Yes, I think it was a step in the right direction. I 100% believe that the local counties should be the ones that are deciding what should happen, particularly even in a massive pandemic, because what we saw, just Summit County had a very different outbreak experience than up in Manila. And the resources in Manila are very different than what we have in Salt Lake. And so I think the local communities and their leadership should be working with the health department to make sure that the needs are met at a local level base. So I'm really happy about giving more control and authority back to our local governments, because that's your job, is to take care of your constituents right there. You're closest to them.
Yeah. And we always like to bring this up, though, because it's we hear Republicans say one thing and then do another. And a good example of that before you got on, but it was the District 53. I mean, Park City had instituted a plastic bag ban, and then we had the state legislature saying, no, you can't do that. So
yes.
Who do you side with then?
You know, that's always going to be one of those tough things. Ultimately, I'm always going to go with county on that. That's the county decision. And if the county elected a body made that choice, why is the state coming in and saying, you can't do that? If the county residents don't like it, then they can reach out to those that they voted for and either vote for someone different next time or work it out with their elected officials. I am not a fan of county coming in. You know, and there's sometimes when there's obvious severe constitutional challenges or concerns, then I understand taking a look at it from the state level. But otherwise, I'm a big proponent of saying let the counties figure it out. They're easily elected and unelected, just as I am.
Okay. Kara, I need to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
State Representative for District 53, Kara Birkeland. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Well, the National Ability Center has announced that it has appointed Dan Glasser as its new CEO. He replaced former CEO Kevin Stickelman, who left last November. Good morning, Dan, and congratulations.
Thanks so much, Leslie. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about yourself and why this was a job you wanted.
Sure. I've been working in the private sector for as long as I can remember, been involved in non-for-profits, specifically focused on autism and multiple sclerosis. And I moved my family here in February of last year, really to find a place that would be better for my son, who has autism, to grow up, a safer, nicer community. And that's how I landed here. And it's been fantastic since I've gotten here. Obviously, it's been challenging with COVID, but the move has been great.
Yeah. So in terms of those careers that you've had prior to this, I mean, you do have some nonprofit experience?
I do. I've been serving on boards and overseeing organizations for years. I've managed big teams, small teams along the way. And I've been a really proactive board member. I more often than not get drafted by the executive director to help with strategy or different functions internally. So I'm not a passive director in those cases. So I've been involved in the details and the minutia in those roles.
Yeah. So on the private sector, though, you've got the means to organize large groups of people and make them accountable, I guess, huh?
Yeah, I think the same thing exists in the not-for-profit. It's different types of accountability. The incentives are different, and you have a lot more focus on passion toward the cause in this case, and I find that to be easier to manage because I'm aligned with that. What the NAC does is directly impacts my family and has impacted my family, so it's natural that I would align toward that, and the staff, which is amazing, and the executive team, which is highly experienced, all share that same sort of passion.
Yeah, I want to talk about that in just a little bit,
sure.
but certainly one of the main jobs of the CEO of a nonprofit organization is the money part of it. Sounds like, again, with a lot of your work in the private sector, I mean, do you feel like you have those skills to get out to the community and ask for money? Or
yeah, I mean, I've been raising money for organizations for years, whether it's capital campaigns or just going out and doing pushing for fundraising for the organizations I'm involved with. I've grown up in a family where your commitment to your community comes in the form of volunteering of your hours, but also volunteering of your paycheck and giving back. And so I've always found it easier to raise money for organizations you cut checks for and asking. And the worst case scenario is that someone says no, and you keep pushing on and you make the case and you show your passion, and I think you usually find a connection with people.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, you do have a very personal connection with the NAC. Tell us about how it's made a difference then for you and your family.
Sure. I'll start with my wife, Melissa, was diagnosed with MS very young. Her first symptoms was when she was 14 years old. And for her, as time has progressed and the disease has progressed, it's limited some of the things that she would want to do. And the NAC provided her an opportunity to go on the ski mountain with neuropathy, where she doesn't have great feeling of what's going on in her feet, and experience the ski experience with the safety of an exceptional world-class instructor and a volunteer working with her. And so that was great for her, as opening up a possibility. She's decided that's not going to be her passion, is alpine skiing, but she's definitely interested in doing cross-country and trying all sorts of other stuff. In the case of Jackson, who was diagnosed with autism at 4, he's now 15, it was more transformative. So that experience of going on the hill gave him confidence and caused him to sort of have the same experience I have when I ski, which is that Yahoo experience of screaming as you go down the hill. And the way it's affected him and our family is Jackson skis with me on a weekly basis, and he now has a job at the mountain because he feels safe there, and he's clearing and working for the corner store, and it's been amazing for him. His confidence and his passion for this city is tied to the NEC, both in terms of the culture here, but what that experience brought to him.
Yeah. So have you started? Or
I start actually today.
Oh,
so you've
first
got my,
day?
Okay. Here I am.
All right. Well, congratulations on that. Anything that the board of directors has kind of given you marching orders for?
You know what? I went through the process saying to the board and to the staff, I have been through the process enough of coming in as a CEO in an organization and acting immediately. And it's never worked out well. So I've said to the board, give me time. Give me 3 to 6 months to really assess where we are. There's fundraising that I'll do throughout that process, but we're going to drive forward on initiatives, but I have to know what we have first and where we can grow it. And I think my background in corporate America helps with that. I think one of the things in the fundraising side is getting more corporations involved in the NAC. We affect so many lives, whether it's young people, older people, military, families, that there are communities in these organizations, public and private, that have a vested interest in what we do. And it's about getting the word out to them and giving them a reason to be involved with us.
Yeah. And I think, again, not to put you on the spot here for your first day, but certainly I think one of the one last expansion parts of NAC, of course, is at the base there of Park City Mountain Resort.
Yep.
And it sounds like you guys are just on hold until we decide what's PEG's doing? Or
yeah, the Mountain Center is a critical, critical piece to our path forward, and it's a great thing for the community here. And we have great partners with Vail and with PEG and with Park City, but we're a small piece of a greater master plan. And so my role in that is to advocate for the NAC, but also be available to the parties and help push this through or guide this and support it any way I can. Thankfully, we're all on the same page. It's just a really complicated issue. This is not a simple thing to solve, and we're going to keep moving it along and partnering with the people we can.
Okay. So in the event that, PEG doesn't move forward with its plans, then are you still then just on hold, or do you just stay in the trailer? And
I think we're going to cross that bridge when we get to it. I don't believe we stay in the trailer long term. But again, it's about partnership with the city. PEG may not go forward. It may go forward. But our work with the municipality, coupled with Vail, is going to guide that process. I absolutely expect that we are going to build the Mountain Center. It's critical for our growth. It's critical for our communities. And we need to provide a better space for our employees and our volunteers to work out of. So it's definitely still a priority.
Okay. And then in terms of just the base there at, Round Valley, I think, are you pretty much done there, or do you have
I don't know that you're in a non-for-profit in the area that we are in terms of adaptive sports. I don't know that you're ever done. I think that you're always improving and enhancing what your offerings are. So our capital campaigns have translated to improvements to our equestrian center, the creation of the hub, which is a climbing wall and a big open space for other things. So I don't see that we're done. I think we'll keep building and keep enhancing. You know, in this space, you're always trying to find the latest and greatest things to enhance the experience for your, end users, and also to provide safe and, positive feedback to your staff. And so I think you always have to continue investing.
Right. So is it back to normal there out at the ranch?
I don't know. Not yet. But I think that, I mean, I don't know what normal is, right? I mean, it's, are we into a new normal? We are still a fair amount of people are remote. We are masks, and we're going to protect both our staff, but also our we have a lot of folks who come through our doors who are vulnerable, and so we have to protect them as well. So I think we are normal as to where we need to be right now. We're going to follow the guidelines of the CDC and the science and move forward as best we can.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to, tell the community?
Nothing. That I'm really passionate and excited about what the NAC is right now. I'm coming into a wonderful situation where I have an incredibly experienced staff, really strong leaders, a great board, and a passionate base of volunteers. So I feel very fortunate in that. And I'm excited to continue to get to know the community and build on this and continue to expand the great things that the NAC has done without ever losing the quality that, Michi White and others have, sort of guided through.
Okay. Well, good luck to you. And again, thanks and congratulations.
Thanks for your time, Leslie. I appreciate it.
You're listening to KPCW at 91.7 and 88.1 FM in Summit County, 91.9 FM in Wasatch County. And of course, you can stream us live at kpcw.org or the KPCW app, or ask your smart speaker to play KPCW radio.